Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam, and with us today is the former director of administration for Vice President Joe Biden, a Joe Biden confidant, and as I'm finding out, who was raised in politics by Ann Richards, which she'll be a topic of discussion at some point in time. I'm very happy to have with us today Mo Vella. Mo, how you doing? Glad to be here. Thank you,
Brian, for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, we're going to take a short break. You've been with me all of 20 seconds. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Hi, and we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me is Mo Vella. And Mo, as a former director of administration for the Vice President, Joe Biden, and now I'm assuming you're still in contact with President Biden a little bit at some point in time. I guess the question I want to ask you, and since this is Just Ask the Question, I'll just ask you, does he have a hope in hell of achieving what he said in his inaugural address, that unity in the United States?
You know, Brian, I think that one thing I think that I learned from him, actually, that I have taken since I worked for him, and is what I think is that he's pragmatic and he's clear-eyed. He's always clear-eyed. He's got that steady as she goes approach to life. So I only share that because it's important to the answer here. He's a realist. He knows this is an incredible task ahead of him. Probably the most severe compilation of crises at ever one time for any president of the United States.
I'd say at least since FDR, but you may be right.
At least since FDR, that's right. And arguably it could even be worse, right? But yeah. Because it's so many have different types, right? So anyway, regardless.
All of them have one source, but.
that's true. But here's what I would say to that. I've been saying this for a while now. If anybody can, it's Joe Biden. And the reason I say that is because I share very few kind of personal stories. One that I will share with you and your audience right now is a part of the answer. And it was on his first trip to South America as the Vice President of the United States. We couldn't have been in more than 30 to 60 days. I can't remember exactly because it was 10 years ago. I was the senior Hispanic on his staff and senior advisor to him. So they invited me to accompany him and Dr. Biden on their first trip, right, to South America, to Chile and Costa Rica, to Central and South America.
Good state.
And we were on Air Force Two, and I was just getting to know them. And we're all sitting, and somehow we all end up, you know how Air Force Two is, and Air Force One, where there's seating areas where you can sit like on a couch and right. People sit around and just chit chat and talk on these longer flights. He ended up on my left, Brian, somehow. Now I'm just now getting to know the Vice President of the United States, right? And so something, because it was my second tenure, I swear to God, I came back a little more confident, a little bit more unfiltered, right? Like right. When I was with Gore, I would like just sit there. I know it's hard to believe, but I was like a wallflower. But no, somehow under Biden, I was just like, felt just comfortable. And he brings that out, I think, in people. So we're sitting there and there's all the staff talking and some Republican senator who I think purposely have forgotten who it was. I just blurted out that blankety blank blank senator so-and-so. And I mean, I said some nasty words about this Republican senator who was denouncing one of Obama's policies that we had just put out there, right? That I believed so fervently in.
Were these four letter words, five?
They were both, probably.
Okay, so I'm getting the gist of it.
To this day, I'm not sure what the hell got into me that I would have said that in front of the vice president, right? Who I barely knew at the time. But he, with his right hand, I'll remember it till my last breath, grabs my left forearm. And in front of all my colleagues and Dr. Biden, he says, "Mo, you're wrong." And of course, you know, you work in the White House. Yeah. You know, when the president or the vice president tells you you're wrong, you're like, exactly. And so I said, "Oh my God, Mr. Vice President, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to offend you." And I said, "But please, please correct me. How am I wrong about this senator?" And he said, "That's my friend." He said, "We don't always agree on how to make America better, but we do agree that we want to make her better."
Wow.
And Brian, I've never forgotten that. So to me, if there's anybody I've ever met in my career that has the ability, genuinely and authentically, to unite factions, it's him. Okay? Because he loves you first. As corny as it sounds,
yeah.
Joe Biden loves you first. Well, then if you give him a reason, right?
Yes.
That's a different ballgame. But the man loves you first. He respects you first. He treats you with dignity first.
Well, that's nice to know. Well, I'll say this much.
Anybody that can do it, it's him, I'm telling you.
McGovern, in Mitch McConnell's office, they even speak kindly of him. And Mitch McConnell speaks kindly of no one except Mitch McConnell. I mean, he was notorious for speaking ill of the previous president, even though he carried the water for him on a few occasions.
I'm chuckling because I don't want to say anything bad about McConnell after I just told that story.
That's who it was about, Mitch McConnell?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't, but I had like a deja vu for a second there. And I was like, don't say anything bad about the Republican Center. Don't say anything bad about the Republicans. Well, it was a reliving a trauma there for a minute.
Well, McConnell, I've told this story a few times, was the first first politician outside of my family. You and I have, you know, my grandfather was the first Lebanese American judge in Louisville, Kentucky. And my uncles were all involved in politics. And so when I was in high school, one of the first things I did was interview, one of the first people I interviewed for our local newspaper was Mitch McConnell. And the day before I went in to interview him, my uncle Pete took me aside and he had worked with him for a few times in the 70s, early 70s, and worked with him. And he said, "Before you go to interview Mitch McConnell, you have to understand one thing." I go, "What's that?" And he goes, "Mitch McConnell's about one thing." And I go, "Okay, what?" And he goes, "Mitch McConnell." And that hasn't changed since 1978.
Wow. That's a very interesting historic perspective, actually, because, you know, he's so relevant right now. I mean, he's so enormously relevant.
Roger Ailes made him possible. That's
an amazing.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, I mean, the one thing that I will say also about Joe Biden on this topic of the ability to unify, it's something that since I worked for him 10 years ago, it's really, and I'm not going to say that it's all because of him. I think a lot of it was what my parents taught me. And it's also been my own life experience, but he reinforced it in working for him and then becoming my friend. And that was that, like, fundamentally, I believe, like he does, that everybody is fundamentally good. Okay. And that I think that we owe it to each other.
Have you met Donald Trump? Asking for a friend.
Well, I'm just going to say this on behalf of a friend, that he might have ruined my entire philosophy.
Well,
it could have been a theory buster, okay? I think he's a theory buster.
Yeah.
But I really believe, I really mean that. Joe Biden, I think, sees the good first, you know?
Okay. But that aside, that's
important what we're trying to unify.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, that's a basis from which you can unify instead of being divisive, being encompassing. But specifically, what does unity look like? Does it? You had said one of the mistakes that the Biden administration has made is not putting a Republican on the cabinet. That aside, there are others saying that if you really want to, there are those who say you should not have a Republican on the cabinet because they're all evil. And I'm not going down that path because that's wrong. But there are others who say, look, if you really want to talk about unity, find a bipartisan bill or something that everyone can agree upon and pass that and show unity. What do you think the first step should be in demonstrating that we're all in this together?
Well, I personally think, and again, these are some very dear friends of mine that are serving in the administration. Right. So I don't want them to feel like I am in any way disrespecting them, because I am their biggest fan and I admire them all for their commitment to our country. And I honor their service. But personally, I'm entitled to believe that I thought it was a softball opportunity to name a Republican in the cabinet. Was it going to solve it all? No, of course not. Let's not be naive, but I believe right now that every word and every deed and every action is going to be watched and measured and evaluated and assessed. And I think as many of those chances that you can get and take the opportunity, right?
Right.
To just cast the line, right? So put a Republican in somewhere that, and I was nodding no, by the way, because I agree with you. I'm not going to go there. Not all Republicans are evil. No. Not all Republicans are bad people. So, and it sounds so cliche. I hate to say it.
But some of my best friends are.
Yes, it's the truth. It's the truth.
But it is the truth, yeah.
It's the truth. And I just think that's what we got to do. And that's what the Biden administration has to do. Every chance you can, whether it's legislatively, whether it's on an executive administrative effort, whether it's a summit or a forum or a roundtable discussion on racial injustice or race relations or law enforcement and race relations. That's the one thing I know about Joe Biden that I am so confident of. When he does hold that summit or roundtable, watch, there will be law enforcement, and there will be Black Lives Matter, and there will be Latino leaders, and there'll be Asian American leaders, and there'll be anybody who feels like they need a chance at the table, he'll invite them to the table. And if they say no, he'll keep on until he gets them there.
Right. Is that right? White supremacist?
He is. So those are the types of things, in my humble opinion, right? I would have liked to have seen them put a Republican, and I thought that would have been a great first sign and signal and a shot across the bow, if you will, right? They chose not to. I don't know why. I have no idea. I've not discussed it with anybody. But anyway, look, they've got a lot of chances to come, Brian, where they get to demonstrate his genuine, because it's genuine for him. So they've got a lot of chances to show that authenticity and sincerity in his desire to literally find common ground.
What? Give me an idea of one that you think.
I just did. Every roundtable, every forum, every discussion that
he. Is that enough, or is that just a first step?
Oh, I think it's a first step, but I think it's more powerful than people realize. Because let's be honest here, a lot of it is about the optics. Okay.
Well, I think it's appearance versus reality. There are white people who believe that what is happening in this country is that they're losing their rights. But really what's happening is they're just becoming equal with everyone else, and they're losing some of their privilege. That
everybody else might be catching up. Novel concept.
A level playing field. But how do you make, because there are people who are just not going to listen. There are people who are convinced, and I mean, I've talked to the short story, you know, long story short, covering the insurrection. I'm out at the Capitol, and I'm talking to these QAnon people and these white supremacists, and they're threatening to kill me. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that stopped one of them from going forward with his plan was when I said, you know, look, I work for Playboy magazine, and they go, oh, can you get me to a party?
All of a sudden you're their best friend, right?
Yeah. All of a sudden. Yeah. So there's common ground somewhere.
There is. Listen, I'll give you a story. I haven't told this story in years, but in 1993, I was appointed to serve at the Department of Agriculture as a political appointee in the Clinton administration, right? Mm-hmm. My uncle at the time happened to be the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Kika de la Garza, right? And so they thought, let's put the nephew in the Congressional Affairs Office and we'll get all our budget, right? Well, it kind of backfired because on the first meeting, Kika, right, my tío Kika, we all go up there to have a meeting on the budget. And he says in that beautiful, strong Mexican accent of his, if you think having my nephew here is going to help you, you're wrong, he says. And I'm like, the blood leaves my head. I'm about to lose my job, right? Anyway, long and short of it is, I end up at the Agricultural Marketing Service. This is the answer to what I would recommend the Biden White House, okay? I get appointed to the Agricultural Marketing Service. And the director of the AMS says to me, as a political, I want you to meet with all 8 division heads of every division, fruit and vegetable, cotton, and the, you know, and go on and on and on, right? Poultry, meat, right? And seed. There were all these divisions. And he says, I want you to meet with the heads of all 8 of them at one time, and you are going to redo our diversity plan because we don't look like America. Well, I call the first meeting, Brian, and it's 8 white people, 7 white men with an average of 38 years of federal service and 1 white woman with 42 years of federal service.
That's a lot of dust.
And I talk about diversity, cultural diversity in recruitment and employment and our workforce. And the looks were like, could kill. They could kill. The looks could have killed. And so this is what the Biden administration has to do. I realized and learned at the age of 30 at that point, wow, I've got to win them over. And I got to win them over in their comfort zone. So I went and got with the director of the cotton division. No, I don't remember which. Poultry. He was first. His name was Mike. He's now deceased, so I can talk about him. But I went and had coffee with him. And I found out his favorite thing to do was to golf. So I said, what are you doing Saturday? We played a round of golf. By the time we laughed together, by the time we talked about our families together, by the time he realized that I honored his service to our nation and that I respected his contribution to our government and our people, he was ready to recruit anywhere I needed him to. The next weekend, fishing with the guy that ran the other department. And you get the picture.
Yeah.
That's what, it sounds trite and it sounds no, so.
It's finding so common interests.
That's what has to happen. You got to go to the folks that, like you said, some of them, I'm convinced of this. There is a faction never going to change their mind.
Right.
You can't. But there are plenty of them who can and who will, if they are approached correctly, if they feel seen and they feel heard, right?
Right.
And they feel respected for their concerns. I don't agree, may not agree with their concerns.
Right.
But they do have the right to express their concerns, not with an AK-47 or an insurrection.
Right.
But in a mutually respectful, right, civil discourse kind of way.
Yeah.
And I think that's what has to happen. We have to talk to each other again. We got to learn that it's okay in a democracy to disagree. In fact, that's what a democracy is.
That's how it works, honestly.
So I think it's communication. I think it's finding common ground. And I think it's all of us getting off our high horses and coming back to each other and saying, let's just talk. Can we just talk? you know?
Well, that's when you talk about everyone get, I hear the word cancel culture, or I hear the word a false equivalency. But the fact of the matter is, and look, I firmly said my whole life, I, even if, you know, if I can't question you and I believe what you believe, then perhaps my beliefs aren't worth a hill of spit. Those that I admire and those I like, I'm going to question them harder. So, I mean, so for what it's worth, I'm not coming at this attacking the left or the right, but I do see that, that politics has become so, so there's such a gap between us, and the divisiveness is such that the far left and the far right, essentially, you can't talk them out of their, you know, the far left is just as bad sometimes.
I agree with you. I agree with you. 150%. You can go back and roll all the tape of the over 500 interviews I've done in the last 14 months. Go back to the primaries when I was denouncing socialism, because to me, that extremism is just as bad as this Trumpism. Okay?
Well, I don't even think we define the terms right anymore. I mean, look, I don't think this.
And I'm going to get hate mail for having just said that.
Well, that's all right.
I believe that.
Yeah, I believe that too. I mean, but I go back to, I don't know that people understand what it is they're arguing. What you know, when they say socialism, do they understand that there are some socialist parts of the country? I mean, you know, schools, and
that's right.
Like we have socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor, but we're never going to be a socialist, as you know, like the way people believe socialism, you know, the bad socialism, nor are we ever going to be a communist nation. We like money too much. So we're a capitalist society. And I don't think that's going to change.
Yeah. But, see, my problem, Brian, was with that whole thing about the socialism, kind of that kind of faction in the Democratic Party.
For example, I know where you're talking about.
My concern for that was always that it's punitive. They come across as punitive in nature.
Yes,
and I'm not comfortable with that. I don't think you have to bring people down in order to raise people up. Do people have to be paid their fair
share?
That doesn't mean I'm saying that the rich don't have to pay their fair share of taxes. That's a different argument. That means let's reform our tax structure. Let's have a fair tax structure. That's different. But to be punitive and say, then why are what would children aspire to, Brian? We aspire to the American dream. So you can't make it look like it's bad to be successful. You don't want to like castigate and demonize success. I'm not going to participate in that. But at the same time, we know we've got to, what did we say today? You and I were together earlier today. What did I say? You're only as good on a football team as your weakest player.
We're going to talk about that. first of all, since you brought that up, I have found that people I work with best in business and in life are people who played a team sport. And usually it's football. Because
that's an interesting observation.
They understand that you're part of something bigger than yourself.
That's right. That's right.
And I remember one of the things my coaches in high school told me, he said, you may not like that guy next to you, but you don't have to like him. You have to work with him.
So that's exactly
right.
You have to
work your butt off for the team. And
you and I might have just solved the whole mystery of what does the Biden administration need to do for unity?
Join a football team?
You may not like them. Well, you may not like them, but you got to learn to work with them.
Yeah.
And that may be the magic phrase.
Yeah.
Right?
That's exactly what my coach said. That's why I asked you when you brought that up, because I have found that over my life that's really, you know, the people who played individual sports or didn't play at all, you know, the ones that were always picked last for kickball, kind of like Stephen Miller maybe, but you know, those kind of, that never really got it.
I can't say a word, remember, because.
I'll take care of it. I had to deal with that for 4 years in the White House, let me tell you. But that kind of working together despite differences is what I find is lacking in today's politics.
No doubt about it. And you still have some folks trying. You do.
Right.
Like, you know, in the Senate, the Senate's a real good, to me, it's like a good experimental lab, right? To assess all of this that we're talking about. you'll see somebody dabble once in a while and just try a little bipartisan something, right? So there's still a little glimmer of hope.
I'll give you better than that. Jim Jordan and Jamie Raskin co-sponsored a bill to help out reporters and a federal shield law so that we don't have to give up our confidential sources. Now, you talk about two people that are as far apart on the political spectrum as possible, and it's Raskin and Jordan. And hell, they had Mike Pence behind them, too, and they still couldn't get it passed. But there's an example of people working together.
It can happen. It will happen again. I predict that it will happen again. I really do. And I think that Joe Biden will lead by example. And I think I said it before, I will say it every day of my life if I have to. You have to be hard pressed to not like Joe Biden.
Well, I'm going to recommend something for the Joe Biden administration that comes straight out of South Texas. If you want people to work together, a little barbacoa, come on over to the house.
Oh, that's not a bad idea.
Have a couple
I'll
of
have it shipped up if you want. I'll have it shipped up from South Texas.
Just have a few, Bill Miller, you know.
But Bill Miller's barbecue.
Yeah, I still have
for those who are listening and don't know, it's Bill Miller's barbecue from San Antonio, Texas. Yeah. Is a tradition in San Antonio.
Yeah, it is a tradition. But just a neighborhood barbecue, or at least getting people together when they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we got to go back to that grassroots level where we have to do it on the local level where you begin this, you know, ability, as we said, to build these bridges and come back together again and again, engage in civil discourse.
Well, you know, there was a place in the Capitol after 5 o'clock where all the senators and congressmen would congregate, and they closed it. And that was
what was the name of that place?
I can't say it without under penalty of death, but but no, it was like the Capitol Club or whatever. And there was
a restaurant too on the Senate side.
Yeah,
where everybody would go
Yeah, and they would just relax, kick back a little bit. No press around, or if there was, it was trusted, and nobody was saying anything. And people they played poker, they had a drink, they talked to one another.
Yes.
And you know, there's something to be said. I don't recommend that all, you know, business is done in the back room. But when you get to know someone personally, it's a little harder.
It matters.
I think it matters,
and that goes back to my Air Force Two story. Because those friendships and those relationships were meaningful connections. You see, it wasn't just, I'm a Democrat, oh, he's a Republican. They developed real friendships like John McCain and Joe Biden, right? And so many others. Teddy Kennedy with John McCain too.
Several
of them, right? Yeah. And, they would be, like you said, at that place near the Senate, and they'd go have dinner or a drink or private meeting. And then the next morning they'd be on the floor going after each other, but never lost that fundamental connection that they had as two people first.
Yeah, I go back to Tip O'Neill when I was interviewing Tip O'Neill, and I asked him about Ronald Reagan. And he goes, you know, he was talking about what a stain he was on the presidency and how he didn't like Ronald Reagan and what a problem he was. He goes, that's between 9 and 5. After 5 o'clock, we're sharing a drink and we're just a couple of Irishmen telling stories.
There you go.
And that we don't have that anymore.
No, we don't have that.
We're going to take a short break.
Okay.
Sorry about that, and we'll be right back. Well, time to pay the bills, folks. And this one I don't mind doing. I've actually used this. If this 2020 holiday season feels like it's been a long time coming, make it worth the wait with Omaha Steaks. Omaha Steaks makes the perfect gift for family and friends or to treat yourself. All shipped directly to your door. They offer everything you need to bring families together for a delicious holiday feast. Okay, or maybe not, maybe just a delicious festival. Their deluxe griller's assortment package includes a variety of entrees, sides, and desserts. Right now, you can get this mouth-watering package. I've never actually seen a mouth water. Oh, well, anyway, plus 4 free burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. And we all need a good meat thermometer. And exclusive price only available to our listeners. So go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code QUESTION into the search bar. Get a jump on gift shopping with Omaha Steaks.
Omaha Steaks isn't just a steak. It's actually a lot of them. It's a fantastic gift and a safe way to share the joy of the season with Omaha Steaks, guaranteed quality and safety with every order. Order the Deluxe Grillers Assortment Package today, and you'll receive 4 free Omaha Steak Burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. That's just a great straight line I won't use. When you go to omahasteaks.com and type question in the search bar, that's omahasteaks.com and type question. And if you need to spell it, it's Q-U-E-S-T-I-O-N in the search bar. And you'll shop for the best gourmet gifts of the season. I like a good raw steak, so enjoy it. It is a lot of fun. Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with us today is Movela, a former, a director of the administration for Biden and a member of the Biden team in the past. Can we call you a Democratic operative? It sounds something like
You know, Brian, you can call me anything you want.
Hey, now, wait a minute. Just don't call me late for dinner. That's my line. Call me anything you want. Just don't call me late for dinner. So where do you think, I guess the big question going forward is, if you're sitting there talking to Joe Biden today, where would you tell him you think he should be 100 days in?
I think that it has to be almost completely around getting control of this virus and getting people vaccinated. That's what I would say to him. I think that if we can accomplish some actual gain ground on getting control of the virus and vaccinating millions and millions of people, that in 100 days, I think he will gain so much confidence from the American people. Because Brian, it'll lower that anxiety and that stress. And I'm not a psychologist, right? But I have to tell you, I can't help but believe that that underlying anxiety, the stress, is contributing to a lot of this anger that's percolating.
I believe and that.
I believe it's contributing to the division too. I really do.
I believe now, that.
Trump made it a political issue with the masks.
I think Trump took advantage of it. I think that discord was there, and rather than trying to ameliorate concerns, he hyped them so he could prey on the fear and the anger. So I blame Trump for a lot of that.
I do too. He came down that escalator.
Yeah.
With the exact game plan that you just described. And he did it till the very end. Fear mongering, dividing people based on some category.
I would get so angry,
right?
Yeah, I would get so angry when people say, "Oh, he's just talking. Oh, that's just him." I'm going, "No, you listen to him. You know who he is." September 23rd, I asked him if he would accept win, lose, or draw a peaceful transfer of power. He couldn't do it. People were like, "Golly gee, can you believe?" Yes, he said it. He said in September 23rd there was going to be an insurrection. He would not accept the results unless he won. So yeah, I would say listen to him. He always told you who he was. God bless you. She was right. When people listen to him.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's all right.
This is why I still call this a phenomenon, because I've tried for 4 years to come up with every possible rationale or reason why people that otherwise had been pretty reasonable, that had been pretty rational, right?
Right.
That had actually been somebody I could actually go out and have dinner with. Somehow they all lost all semblance of reality.
They lost their freaking mind. I mean,
I don't get it, Brian. I don't. It's a phenomenon. Psychologists and social workers, in my opinion, are going to be evaluating and assessing it for decades to come, because I think it.
Well, in that sense, Donald Trump was good for the economy.
For that sector, for that sector, he could keep him in business for years. But I mean, I'm going to go somewhere that I probably shouldn't go, because I know it's going to give me a lot of hate.
Go ahead.
But I mean, it has to be said, and it's been said many times, and I'm not saying it for the first time by any means. but it's the same psychological evaluation and mental evaluation and assessment we do about Hitler.
Yeah, I know.
And how he meticulously, judiciously, deliberatively, everything he said, everything he did was all for an end goal.
Yeah. Well,
this man is, I'm sorry, very similar pattern, Brian.
Yeah, I don't disagree. But but my concern, honestly, is not for Donald Trump. He's 74 years old. I don't think he's going to run. I don't think he's going to run for in 2024. I think
he can't run from prison. So you can't run for your prison. So.
I think that he's done. What I'm concerned about is the smarter, younger demagogue and desperate.
Yes. And this is part of the phenomenon to me. Friends, these are college educated.
All ships directly.
Some of them are bright as hell.
To bring families together.
They're smart people.
Smarter than Trump. When you go to OmahaSteaks.com.
How did they fall prey? But you see, remember, Hitler also convinced and attracted and resonated with smart people too.
In the search bar.
Yeah. This is much bigger than any one of us can figure out. I think there's a psychology.
It is a lot of fun.
There's something that has to be figured out about the brain.
If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter
mental health
and
follow
our official page, JATQ Podcast, for all the updates to leave
our fundamental values and principles.
Podcast.
How can one human being lead you to that place of darkness? That's what I want the question answered, but nobody can answer it. Well, that's what happened. They were all led to darkness.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't think it was. I'll be honest with you. I think some were led to darkness, but I think some of them lived their lives in darkness. And it was Donald Trump who gave them the light and gave them attention.
That's a really excellent point, actually. Yeah. And, you know, and I think I'm not referring to them, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I'm referring to those. Honestly, let's use the Republicans in Congress as an example, because they're a perfect example.
Yeah.
They know better.
They should know, yeah.
You know, you're right.
Some of them have benefited from
it. They clearly don't know better. They should have known better.
I think Mitch McConnell didn't realize either. I think Mitch tried to play Trump. Trump played Mitch. And in the end, McConnell, outlasted him. But, I mean, McConnell played Trump for the judges. Some of the members of Congress jumped on the Trump train. So they saw that they could isolate a constituency that had money and they could get reelected that way. So it was their own personal fortune.
Power,
they never really
power.
Bought Trump. Yeah. They bought the power. And then there are those who are the honest to God believers and who still believe to this day that Donald Trump won the election and that we all cheated to make sure that he didn't win.
And that he was sent by God.
God. Yeah. So you grew up in South Texas, you Catholic boy?
I grew up Catholic.
Yeah.
About the age of 21 or 22. Yeah, no, I'm very open about this. You know, I think when you, for 21 years, you hear that because you're gay, you're going to burn in hell and that it's wrong. At some point you realize, you know, I don't think I want to attend a church that doesn't believe in me as a person, right? Well, so I left the church, right? But, you know, I do get...
Well, Mo, they told you if you masturbated, you were going to hell.
Well, Brian left.
I was out of that church by 9 or 10, baby.
Wow, that's an early start, but that's all.
Maybe too much information, but
that's definitely TMI. Yeah. No doubt about it. But yeah, you know,
but I feel
you. I left the church, yeah, because I mean, honestly, I.
But my point, my point in asking you, if I can, I'm sorry, I didn't. Yeah. But my point in asking you is, you and I grew up in a Catholic faith, and the Catholics are very, I mean, remember the John Kennedy's saying he had a contingency of bishops and nuns to see him. And he said, make the bishops wait. They all vote Republican anyway. I mean, it's a very conservative bunch and they're the ones that believe in God. And you got Mike Pompeo, who's a very conservative Catholic, who, and it's the evangelicals that believe in God. And I don't understand how they can believe in God and equate Donald Trump with God. It don't make no sense to me. I mean, did they read the same Bible I did?
You might have heard me say this before. I don't know, but I am at a point where, and I'm very, very, very honest about this, whether it's a Hindu friend, a Buddhist friend, a Muslim friend, a Christian, a Jew, a Catholic, whatever it is, if they equate their higher being and their religious beliefs and say that Donald Trump is okay in the eyes of their religious beliefs, I simply say to them, I don't have any interest in knowing your God. Because if your God is okay with everything this man has said and done, then I'm not okay with that God. It's that simple.
Your imaginary man in the sky is full of shit.
If they're okay with that,
yeah,
I'm like, I'm perfectly fine not believing at all.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Tell me, you know, you bring it up. I mean, growing up Catholic, outside linebacker in high school, we found that out earlier, which I just love. Outside linebacker, growing up gay in South Texas, that had to be. I mean, I know the culture in South Texas well. That had to be difficult, was it?
Or the 1960s. It's important to add that, and it's important to probably add one more thing, which was my father was, you know, and my uncle were pretty well known. Our family were kind of leaders in the community, judges and lawyers and such. And so you have to add that too, because it was like growing up almost in the public eye. So I don't know that I could have had a more perfect storm. And so, frankly, the vast majority of my childhood, I wrote a book. It's called Little Secret, Big Dreams, because I wanted to share the challenges and the anxieties of growing up with your secret, because I wasn't able to even. I knew, though, Brian, in a very strange way, at the age of 7, I already knew I was gay, but I knew I couldn't say it, be it, do it, live it, express it. I knew I couldn't. So I did everything a Texas boy was supposed to do. Outside linebacker, baseball, basketball, hunting, fishing. Loved it all, by the way. Ironically, I loved it all. And I excelled at sports. You know, but I had to live in an imprisonment. And when I decided at the age of 17 that this juxtaposition wasn't, the locker room wasn't working for me anymore. Like, I couldn't deal with this locker room situation. So I realized to just survive, I had to like get out of sports. Well, the football players turned on me, my friends of all my youth. And so every day in my junior year of high school, they would wait outside my classes and call me a faggot every day for 6 months of my life.
Jeez.
Every day. And I contemplated taking my life in my junior year of high school. I came very close to committing suicide, but something inside, I to this day, I can't tell you what it was, but something said, no, you, there's a reason for you to stay here, right? Like there's a purpose for you. And, you know, lo and behold, I went on to make a little bit of American history, not much, but a little bit. Knocked down some glass, shattered some glass ceilings, and knocked down some doors in the White House. And you know,
keep to this doing day, it, brother, keep doing it.
You know, look, I share the story. I wrote the book on purpose because if I could save one person's life, it's worth it, right? And one person's life, because there's some kid right now, some adult that might be watching your podcast,
and they don't come. What you know, I've talked with friends, and I had friends growing up who could not confront those feelings.
That's right.
And when I would say, look, you're my friend, no matter what, I don't, you know, I one time remember famously telling somebody, I don't care if you came to me and told me you're going to marry your rosebush. Doesn't matter me. Whatever you want to do is you. That's you. I'll do me, you do you. And you're still my friend. I can't understand. So that was always difficult for me to understand people that would just, usually the ones that were closeted and the most or the most angry were the most closeted, I found.
Well, now that you allowed me to share this such a personal story. I got to close it off for your listeners on this story because 20 years later, no, not 20, 14 years later, I become the youngest chief financial officer to the Vice President of the United States, Al Gore, and his senior advisor on LGBTQ and Latino affairs, right? And I'm in the White House and I fly home with my partner at the time. And we fly home to Little Harlingen where I grew up. And I had a good gay man that I am. I had too many bags to carry on. So I had to check them. And so I'm waiting at the baggage thing, right? Carousel. And the baggage porter comes over with his little cart. And it was one of the four football players who called me a faggot every day. He grabs my bag and he sees a White House luggage tag, Mo Vella, the White House. And he goes, Mo!
Love and you too, brother.
I didn't hug him. And I just said, you know what? It's good to see you again. Could you please make sure those bags get to that van right over there? And he took all the bags to the van. And it was the one moment, I'm not really a spiteful person. I'm not a revenge type guy.
Right.
But it was a moment where I felt like it was justice had to prevail. And it was the greatest moment I didn't tip him. And it was like my one little moment.
Cheap bastard.
Yeah, I just was like, you know, man.
No, yeah, that's right. Well, let me ask you one other question before we go to our second break here. You lived in South Texas and for years, I covered what was, when I first started covering these things, they were called illegal subdivisions. We know them as colonias.
Colonias, yes.
And Rio Bravo and El Ceniso down on the border of, where I was the first one to write about them.
Wow.
Many years ago.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and in fact, we could talk about that for hours.
We could. And by the way, not to, I don't want to get you off track. Yeah. I took Al Gore down there as vice president to a colonia.
Yeah, that's, well, the first one I covered, El Ceniso on the border and Rio Bravo, they were helping to bring illegal immigrants into the U.S. and selling them land that they didn't own for $100 a down and then $100 a month on an open-ended contract for their lives.
It was like an enormous amount to those folks.
Yes, but I recently went back down there and it was, this whole border has changed in the last, first of all, there's not caravans coming over at any moment. That's a crock. But one thing I saw that was disheartening and was the amount, it's still, the poverty is horrible, but during the coronavirus, there are so many underreported people because they're homeless, because they're from the immigrant community. And I just wonder if we're going to ever know the true scope of how this virus, this pandemic, has hurt those people in the colonias and in the poor areas. And Harlingen has a lot of that.
The whole valley does, Brian.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever know the exact numbers to your point, but what we do know is that Latinos have been disproportionately impacted. And so I think you can take the data that we do have when it comes to Latinos being impacted by coronavirus. And I think you can extrapolate very easily and probably very accurately to know, to account for the fact that there is a good chunk of folks that are not accounted for through these unincorporated colonias that you reference, other pockets of extreme poverty where I grew up down on the border in South Texas. And I'm very proud, I now that we're talking about South Texas, I'm very proud of the work that my cousin is the congressman from the 24th district, 26th, I don't know which district. I never can remember the number, but Brownsville.
Yeah.
Brownsville, Harlingen, all the way up Philemon Vela. I'm very proud of my cousin and I'm proud of my brother, who's the CEO of the hospital system down there, Valley Baptist Hospital Center. And on the front lines right now during the coronavirus. So you just touched on an issue very dear to the Vela family. Right, with my brother fighting on the front lines, cousin fighting in Congress. And of course, I'm probably the slacker here of the three. But
you find it offensive when, you know, it's like they're, look, having lived down there for years and worked down there, I personally found it offensive. So if you don't understand, if you do, I understand. But I found it offensive to have the President of the United States tell me that the alien hordes were coming over any day to take away our way of life. and that they're lazy and don't want a job, but at the same time, they're taking all the good jobs. And by the way, every immigrant family I've ever interviewed, and I mean not bar none, all ascribe to the ideals and the dreams of America. So what the
I find it so overwhelmingly offensive. I get a little emotional because I think people forget something really important. Do you really think that a mother or a father would grab their children, trek 1,000, 2,000 miles, risk being raped and beaten and tortured by coyotes? Do you think that they do that because they want to come and take our jobs? They're doing that for the same reason that any parent better do for their child, which is merely survival.
Yeah.
So that child has a better future than they do. And if you can't understand that, Donald Trump and his followers, you can't understand that, then honestly, you're inhumane. You lack fundamental humanity. Now, am I saying an open border? Don't come at me with that crap. That's right. Not what I'm talking about.
No one is.
Okay? No one is. And they go there because, again, fear, fear, fear. There is nothing to fear. The fact of the matter is, as Joe Biden already put in that executive order, we got to go down there and figure out why they're leaving. Do you think they want to leave their country? We don't want to leave our country.
Part of it is we're the blame for it. If you look at
the drugs that we buy, yes. By the way.
Well,
okay,
it goes back.
We contribute to this problem.
Well, we created it. It's our foreign policy in Central and South America that created the banana republics. And I can't remember the Marine who wrote the book back in the 20s and 30s about, indefinite war and how we created that situation. It hasn't changed in 100 years.
So the bottom line is they're not coming over in hordes.
No.
They never have been coming over.
And they're coming over less than they were in the 80s when I was covering the border. And I'll tell you.
I grew up there. That was my entire life, my whole foundation of my life. Right? We would go back and forth. We don't have, you did that when you worked in Laredo. You'd go have lunch in Nuevo Laredo, or I'd go lunch in my
house.
Just come right back. It was such a beautiful way of life. But there was nobody taking each other's jobs. There was no, and this is all fundamentally, in my opinion, fundamentally, this is all driven by some semblance of racism.
Well, it is
rooted in racism. It is plain and simple in my eyes.
The one story that did it for me, then we will go to break. The one story that I remember, I was 24 years old. I was covering the border, and they were fishing some illegal aliens out of the Rio Grande who had drowned. And usually you didn't drown because it's, in the Laredo area, it's knee deep. It's hip deep. People walk across. But the coyotes had gotten a hold of these people and had killed them. And there was a mother who had been, her head was bashed in, and she had apparently drowned or died right on the banks. And her 2-year-old daughter was holding on to her when the Border Patrol came and found them, and she was crying. And all I could hear her say was, mama, mama. And if you cannot hold out any kind of feeling for people.
If that doesn't impact you, then something's wrong with you, Brian.
Yeah.
That's where I've been on this for 40 years. If you can't feel any compassion, empathy, or love in those stories, something's wrong with you. And if your God is okay with that, I will end this segment by saying, I don't want to know your God again. If your God's okay with that, get away from me. You're toxic. You're toxic.
And we're going to take a short break on that note. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
Hi, and we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and it's a joy having Mo Vela with us today. Mo, just a joy getting to know you. So we're going to take this last little block and get to know you a little bit better. So
I'm worried.
So if you're sitting in a desert island and you have electricity, what albums are you taking with you?
Oh my God. Now, Brian, I announced earlier I was openly gay and very comfortable as a gay man. Yeah. Of course I'm taking Bette Midler, Cher, and Barbara Streisand. Hello.
All right, rock and roll. By the way, I like Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand.
Well, Kelly Osbourne is a dear friend of mine. She's like my little sister. So I think Ozzy would be very upset if I didn't take Black Sabbath with me, even though I cannot handle listening to it. I was in him and Sharon's home a couple years ago, and they were showing me all of his gold records or whatever. He has this incredible basement that all the walls are covered with all of his, what do you call them? Gold records or whatever. Yeah,
right? Or platinum or whatever.
Yeah, platinum or whatever. And I had to just smile and nod because I was like, I don't know the name of that song. Oh shit. Oh my God, I've never heard that one either. And I was just going from one to the other going, I don't have any clue. So, okay, just in honor of Kelly, I'd say, I'd take Black Sabbath. How's that?
Fajitas or carne asada?
Oh my God, fajitas.
Yes.
As long as I have tortillas and maíz.
Tortillas, maíz, or harina?
I'm gluten intolerant, so it has to be maíz.
Yeah. If they're made right.
Or I'll never make it back off the island.
Well, if the corn tortillas are made right, they're better than the flour.
I agree with you, especially right off of the comal.
Yeah.
With some butter and a little salt. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's nothing better.
Jalapenos.
So fajitas with a little bit of queso fresco and a little salsa. Yes.
Yes. What about jalapenos? Yes or no?
No, for me, honestly, nachos, a few, but I'm not a big jalapeno guy.
I once watched a guy at a jalapeno eating festival in Laredo, ate like 58 of them in minutes. I don't know how he lived.
I cherish life. I would not.
So what's your guilty pleasure when it comes to food?
Food. I was about to reveal gambling.
Well, that works too. I guess if you eat the chips.
I need to hear the food, so I'm like, gambling.
What's the over-under on that?
That's so funny. Well, remind me not to play poker with you.
Yeah. I'm going to play. So, can you teach me?
What now?
I've never played. Can you teach
guilty me? Pleasure with food. Let's see. Wow. Oh, French fries. Oh,
oh yeah.
Oh, heavens. I mean, I now only eat 1600 calories a day and walk 2 miles a day, and I eat only healthy now. But in the past life, it was definitely French fries. Let's just put it this way. I got this way because of French fries. Okay. So, but you want to know, speaking of this, right, I'm working on this, I just realized I had an epiphany about last week where I realized that of all the shame I've had of being overweight, for the first time now with the coronavirus and the vaccines, being fat might save my life because I get the vaccine a little earlier. Yeah,
that's right. That's what I'm saying anyway.
I'm in 1B. I'm in 1B.
I have cholesterol. Can you give me a shot?
I swear to God, I am contemplating walking into the pharmacy with a sign that says obesity.
I'm going to have one that says morbidly obese just to be safe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm like, excuse me. I'm just going to cut the line. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm morbidly obese. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. You're just regular obese. I get morbid.
French fries are my guilty pleasure.
And tell us something about yourself that you have, I know you've done a lot of interviews, but you haven't told anyone that we would love to hear.
Well, I kind of revealed it a minute ago. I don't think people realize how much I love to gamble. I've never talked about it. Really? I've never said it in an interview ever in my life. I don't even know that I referenced it in my book, to be honest. Really? With you. My book was a tell-all, I thought. Really, it wasn't.
So you're a degenerate gambler, is that?
Yes, and you want to know, and I'm going to turn something funny into a little bit of a more serious life lesson, honestly.
That's fine.
In the spirit of, because I believe that we always have to live authentically and we have to be vulnerable, because I think that's what bonds us as human beings. So in the spirit of being truthful, the pandemic actually helped me overcome what was probably becoming a little bit of a problem. Wow. I was gambling a little bit too often. And when I was gambling, losing a little bit of control. I wasn't quite, I don't think, in a serious place of problem, but I was headed there. And so, Mama used to tell me growing up, from all bad can come some good.
Yes.
And so for me,
that's one of the Trump administration.
This prohibition or this inability to go gamble has actually made me realize that I'm just fine without it. And that was a beautiful lesson that's come out of this horrific and tragic time period.
I don't mind gambling myself. I'm usually a poker player, but I during the beginning of this pandemic, I put together a documentary and we drove cross country right after the initial lockdown I think it was early March.
Yeah.
And if you've ever been to Vegas, the most sobering sight.
I can't even answer that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. If you've ever been to Vegas in the last year, in the last 10 minutes, it was seeing the strip empty.
Shut down.
Completely shut down.
Now that would be a sight to behold, really.
I'll never forget that. And I've been, to a few places on the planet and I never thought I would see
a ghost town. Oh
yeah,
my God.
Vegas is a ghost town.
So over the top vibrant, right?
Yeah.
To go from over the top vibrant to shut Nothing. Down. I can't even imagine what that must have looked
like. The only place of them was the McDonald's.
God love them.
Yeah. I mean, come the apocalypse, it's going to be Keith Richards and cockroaches and McDonald's.
And McDonald's.
That's all that's going to survive. Well, listen, Mo, I appreciate your time. I'd love to have you back anytime if you're up.
Well, Brian, it's been nothing less than a pleasure. It really has been. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I hope that our conversation in some way empowers somebody.
I do too. I hope so.
Believe in themselves and remember each of us, every single one of us is unique and worthy. That is the most important lesson of all. I hope that they get from our conversation. You're unique. You're worthy. Every one of you.
And have a laugh every once in a while.
Oh, we did plenty of that. And yeah. I'll come back just for the laughter. How's that?
That sounds good. The name of the show is Just Ask the Question. Thank you, Mo, for being with us. And we'll catch you.
My pleasure.
Next time. Thank you.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.